Just the one other situation I wanted to mention today was Toll Holdings. We had some figures come into the market through RiskMetrics that $55 million was paid out to a bunch of executives on a series of unbelievable assumptions, buying out their options, assuming a share price of between 30 and 40 bucks. It's now below 8. Clearly, now that these figures are in the market was completely misled. The shareholders were completely misled on the basis, the assumptions surrounding the payout. And surely there's a no-brainer action there to recover 30 or 40 million from particularly Little and Rose Thorne, the rich listers who got plenty of cash, recovering for shareholders. Have you had a look at that one? And
Dean Pash alerted us probably about the same time as he alerted you. So we've had a look at it, and we continue to have a look at it, but our initial feeling was that it was very difficult. Maybe John would like to elaborate.
We're not activists. We're litigators seeking recovery for victims. And the victim, if there is one in any of these management agreement structures, and I think I'm sympathetic to your views, we've talked about it before, is the company. The actual loss to the shareholders, if it is $50 million, inappropriately, either through breach of fiduciary duty or whatever, loss to the shareholders, it's quite a small amount in comparison to the capitalisation of the company. So even if there was a shareholder claim, the question is whether it's sufficient material and sufficient enough appetite of victims to get together to make the project worthwhile. The real project there is the company's project. The company is led by the board. It's very unlikely the company will take that action. So it's left to a derivative suit, and unfortunately in Australia we don't have a derivative suit like in New Zealand, where shareholders can get the company to take the action if the court considers it's appropriate using the company's money. Now, you know, that's something for reform, but we do our share of lobbying, but that's not our business.
Another possibility, Stephen, is ASIC put itself in the company's shoes. They've done that in the case of West Point, and that's something where clearly ASIC should have a look at it, and given the profile of it and given the concentration on compensation issues now, there's a chance maybe they will have a look at it.
Given that you've negotiated a number of settlements in the last 18 months or so, can we understand how important the perceived amount of ammunition in your holster bag, the 20 million, the 50 million, the 90 million, has been as you've done those negotiations?
One word, really, zero. It's obvious, isn't it? The bigger bag you've got, the meaner you at least appear to be, and the more you can appear to be able to run the course.
When the bag was under 15 million, we didn't look real mean. now we're 80 to 90, we look really mean. It's improved it a lot.
As you said, I think two or three weeks ago, we should change our motto. What was it, Hugh? Basically, prepare for war to achieve peace.
Yeah.
Just to Stephen on this Babcock and Brown thing, I'm no lawyer, but it seemed a hard road to go down, because even though the market cap of Babcock and Brown is 100 million, I don't know what it is, they've done a $1 billion transaction, they pay 1%, that's $100 million fee. Their argument is, well, we could have got UBS to do that, and UBS's fee is 1%, or thereabouts, that's $100
million.
10%.
Sorry?
1% is 10 million.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. My maths is obviously.
You're accurate.
Well, but the 100 million would have been an accumulation of those sorts of fees on a very large transaction, I'm sure. And that would be their defence, that if they went out into the market, they would have paid a comparable fee. Now, they might have sort of put a bit of icing on the cake, but I just think it'd be hard to go and get them.
Our office is just around the corner. Any shareholders who want to give us a hand to chase these meds, we're always happy to see them.
I mean, it'd be good to get them, but I don't know how you could.
No.
Is it likely that you'll be looking at the institutions that have short well, been involved in short selling, particularly in the light of the huge losses. What price were they getting these shares back at, and were there any losses to trustees and fund managers? Are they your targets?
Not particularly. Short selling. Criticism of short selling in general, I think, sort of shooting the messenger. Eddie Graves was a great critic of short selling, but I don't think that that was his real problem, as we're starting to see now. So, look, if some irregularities emerge, there was one particular irregularity emerged when we, I think it actually was with ABC, where we found out that there was very heavy short selling of ABC that was probably based on inside information. If we could establish that and go through and identify that short seller who happened to be in a different jurisdiction, then we'd look at it, but we had a quick look at it and it wasn't too hard.
Yep. Alan, on those sort of matters and the one that Stephen was talking about earlier, our test, our self-imposed test, is that we're virtually certain of winning. That means that we protect ourselves from big losses. So unless you're virtually certain of winning a short selling case, you would refer as a business decision, whether or not it's inappropriate conduct or not. So I think the likelihood of any short selling suit